Welcome to the Revenue Lounge, a podcast for revenue operations professionals who want to understand the various facets of this important go-to-market function. In each episode, the team at Nectar interviews revenue warriors on how they are reimagining revenue operations in creative and disruptive ways, and what are their secrets to building a scalable and predictable revenue engine. Let's get started.
As CS teams race to adopt AI, the real work is happening earlier. Unifying fragmented data, understanding relationships beyond usage metrics, and catching risk before it hits the forecast. The future of customer success isn't about reacting faster. It's about seeing clearly sooner. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Revenue Lounge podcast. I am your host, Randy Likas. In today's episode, we will unpack what it truly means to build an AI-ready customer success organization. Joining me today is Chad Gorman. Chad is the Vice President of Customer Success and Solutions for North America at LivePerson. Chad's team drives conversational AI outcomes for several of the world's largest companies. Prior to LivePerson, Chad led VMware's cloud's global customer success organization, and Chad brings practical operator-led perspective on how data, AI, and human relationships come together to drive retention, expansion, and long-term customer success. Chad, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Randy. It's a pleasure. Love to meet you.
I'm looking forward to having the discussion. So, Chad, what I usually like to do is start out and just have you maybe walk us through your background, career journey, and then your current role today.
Sure. So I grew up in contact centers in operations, but really established my career in IT at DirecTV before moving to the dark side, the vendor side. A colleague of mine at DirecTV left to go to a company called Splunk. He reached out. He said, "You got to come work here." And I definitely knew what Splunk was, but I did not know what a CSM was. The interviews wowed me. So I took a leap and I never looked back. Hyper growth company at the time. And I was fortunate enough to very quickly matriculate as well as help build a true scalable CS engine and organization. That was when I discovered my love for customer success. Found a true passion. And even now, 9 years later, customers will always be at the center of everything that I do until I retire. As you said, from there, went to VMware, leading the cloud CS business, but for the first time, truly owning a book of business. And then finally, things came full circle with LivePerson and software that empowers brands to have better conversations with their customers, conversational AI helping both the brand's customers and the brand's contact centers, full circle. So at LivePerson, I lead customer success and professional services, focusing on helping enterprises deploy conversational AI safely, effectively, and in ways that measurable business outcomes are delivered.
If you think about what LivePerson is doing around conversational AI, and as I was looking at the business, I think the positioning now is being a AI agnostic orchestration and trust layer platform, right? Providing the CX infrastructure that's embedded into workflows. I think when we talk, AI is everywhere, right? And so many different companies are coming up with different AI solutions. And I'd be curious to understand, as your team, you know, is talking with folks about adopting AI, there's different perceptions of risk, different approval gates, different confidence in the adoption of that. I imagine your team's probably trying to, if I were to say it, like be like outcome translators, right? How does it help with the reduced cost and improve productivity, so on and so forth. I'm just curious, like, how does your team work with customers to help alleviate some of those AI concerns? What maybe are some of the biggest challenges or obstacles and that you typically see or your team sees? And then how do you coach your team to overcome them?
Definitely some of the bigger hurdles that we see. You mentioned governance and AI councils. And that's, I think, the most important piece behind everything that we do when we engage with the customers, and they have to know this when we're in the software cycle, is how we will shepherd them through that process. I think that's how it's going today in today's marketplace. If you're not, you can sell software all day long, but if you're not around to help them get all the way through, and this isn't just a shameless customer success plug from 2012, this is more holistically as a company, you have to help that customer get all the way through all those gates. Yep. How? You have to set expectations up front and early on. Do you have governance and compliance commitments to hit? Do you have AI councils? A lot of brands, especially when you get into FinServe, have AI councils. How do you navigate that? Do we have all of our paperwork, if you will, all of our legal docs and all that kind of stuff that you submit in RFP responses, already prepared to anything you could do to help expedite the cycle. And then obviously when it gets to actual deployment time and adoption time, there's so many different solutions out there. In our world, conversational AI, how you as a brand engage with your customers, it's about what are you trying to do? What are you trying to solve for? You have to have that conversation up front, pre-sales for sure. What are we solving for? Are we solving for a reduced cost to serve? Are we trying to take cost out of the business? Or are we trying to generate revenue? Or are you trying to do a little bit of both? My favorite are the ones that want to do both, but the main underlying reason is actually having the best in class customer experience for their industry. Mm-hmm. And so navigating that with them, a lot of the brands don't know, funny enough. Like, oh, containment rate and NPS and CSAT. They don't know what they don't know. And so helping them say, here's what your peers are doing. Here is what we can do. Set the expectations. Get all that paperwork, AI council stuff out of the way. Here's what we can do short, mid, and long term to help you get to that ideal end state.
And one thing I was noticing as I was preparing for our conversation is, I guess over the past several quarters, you've had to navigate some turbulence in the business, right? From what I understand, the CS function has really been elevated from a post-sale support to a revenue insurance. And I'm not going to go too deep into the specifics of your business, but more generally, I'm interested in how that shows up in maybe new metrics, new telemetry that's needed, leading indicators, evolving playbooks, and like how you manage that change. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. I think so. Early warning system is one of the first things whenever I come into a place, if it's not already there, you have to establish an early warning system. Everything behind anything having to do with an early warning system or any other things that I'll say here shortly is data. Data is the most important thing. Getting visibility into what is that book of business that you're stepping in and taking ownership of. What's the book? What does it look like? What's the risk profile? Especially understanding where the risk is. And that's before you can even talk early warning. That's kind of after warning. And so definitely have stepped into some places where the warning signs, once you get the data structure built and stitched together, the warning signs are in a lot of places that you got to dig in and figure out what the risk is. And of course, do the de-risking.
Yeah. And we'll dig into a little bit of like some of the mechanics of how you look at what that risk looks like and how AI kind of plays into that. But as you think about those sort of digging into that data and looking for those new signals, if you will, you probably had to set up some different telemetry, right? That was needed before. And you probably had to socialize like why that was important with the other executives on the team. There's a lot of change that goes on with that. And so I'm just curious, like what that change management process kind of looks like and how do you carry the organization forward?
Absolutely. Change management is obviously the most important piece, especially if you're coming into an organization. It's a very graceful, delicate art form to navigate. Table stakes is, to your point, you have to be able to articulate the what's in it for me, for everybody cross-functionally. What we need to do is understand what the book of business looks like and what needs to be done to get the book of business where it needs to be, ultimately. When you talk about tooling and systems, obviously, pretty much everywhere has data across systems that has to be stitched together, integrated to a more holistic view to give you a full picture, whether there's AI involved in that or not. Obviously, it makes things a lot easier. We've talked about that. CRM and PS tools show engagement and strategy. Product analytics show usage. Support cases show friction. And comms show outreach. But until you can weave those together to give a picture, brand by brand, ARR dollar by ARR dollar, you can't automate or optimize what you can't see, and you can't articulate the health of the business until you get that picture.
So let's dig into the data a little bit. So data is so fragmented. It lives in so many different places, and it could be in CRM, it could be in product usage or product analytics. And so I'm curious, like, when you try to look across the data, how do you synthesize it, first of all? How do you make sense of it when you've got different dashboards or silo data that maybe don't all add up? What's the role that the data plays? And then how do you go about trying to synthesize that when it lives in so many different places?
Oh, man. I think you can sense a common theme here is that the data, especially when it gets to leveraging AI to make all the good things happen, data is a non-negotiable, period, full stop. You have to get the taxonomies and structure and hierarchies right, especially when you're dealing, if there's customer data, brand data, merging that into your broader set of tooling. But you do have to feed, in our case, LLMs, a framework and structure so it can guide and assist. And then, again, whether there's AI involved or not, just knowing, kind of the hardest part that I've seen with a lot of different organizations is knowing where you're, what the data is and where the data lives and how to get the data.
Yeah,
that's the most important piece.
I'm curious, like, so a lot of organizations will put a lot of the data in a data warehouse because it's siloed, right? They'll try to bring it out to a data warehouse and then they'll build a telemetry on top of that. Is that a similar approach that you guys take as well?
Yeah, but again, so we've run into that where data is in different places, not all in one data lake. And again, there's different solutions out there that anybody can leverage. But I think some of the more common ones, if you look at it, would be Power BI is probably Power BI, maybe Tableau out there as well. But again, knowing where your data is, having that visualization layer that can orchestrate the data and feeding the, it's part of the early warning system as well, right? Feeding the data threshold. So when there's a deviation from the norm, something gets flagged. You're able to see, hey, usage dropped or engagement's dropping or whatever those key markers may be, so that you can quickly identify. And this also goes, not just that there's a problem, right? It's also good if you get that data right and the visualization right, the early warning system, it's also a really happy warning system so that you can identify upsell, cross-sell opportunities.
Yep. So there's so many different use cases that you could look at where you could use AI, right? So you can use it for churn prediction. Churn prediction is based on different risk signals that you talked about. You can do it for QBR automation. There's sentiment analysis and meeting summaries. There's forecasts. There's so many different use cases. Where do you think the low-hanging fruit is, if you will, on the, or I don't even say a low-hanging fruit. What's the most impactful use cases that you think you can use in the CS motion to identify some of these early risks that you're talking about?
Yeah, so early warning system for sure. Not just the bad, but the good too. Proactive notifications of churn risk based on the key markers. As far as brand or customer facing, digital CS, as has been termed in the industry for so long, I think digital CS is evolving into something better than the automation workflows that it's been, creating a customer experience, not just for enterprise customers, but for all, piggybacking on why the setup of data and the data infrastructure is so important. Once you're able to access the data with confidence, you can be able to scale that based on all the things. A truly consistent, repeatable, and this is, I think, the game changer part, is a very personalized approach to all parts of the customer based on the analytics to prescribe for them and guide them based on exactly where they are so that it's a lot more personalized.
Let's dig into the early warning system a little bit. So what are those signals that make up that early warning system? And I guess there's probably there's both leading and lagging indicators in terms of what those risks might be. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, for sure. Engagement, I think, is a huge one that often gets overlooked in the early warning system.
Yep.
Product usage is probably a table stake that everyone would use, right? If you're able to set up the thresholds in the right way where you can find the deviation from the norm, again, in a bad or good way. Relationship management is key. So then back to that engagement. If you have that engagement and you identify some of these markers in your early warning system, when you get the right stakeholders, all that fun stuff, then you can have an informed conversation as opposed to just being ghosted and surprised later.
Yep. So the engagement piece, we think about it as relationship intelligence, right? And as you mentioned, it's just becoming that much more critical. And so if we unpack engagement a little bit more, I would imagine in your world, you're talking to the operations teams, you're talking to the CX leaders, you're talking to this IT or CIO organization, you got risk, compliance, you got procurement, you got a bunch of different stakeholders that sort of make up the relationship intelligence. How do you define relationship depth? And when you look for those signals and you look for that engagement, what are you looking for specifically that can help with some of those early warning systems?
We are definitely entering the realm of art and science now, for real.
Yeah.
Relationship intelligence is key for all of the selling, right? Upselling, cross-selling, and retention motions. Understanding who we have relationships with, who we don't, who the promoters are, who the detractors, neutral. Having and capturing all that data is very key so that you can understand what the white space is. Understanding the relationship dynamics within a given brand is also very important. We need to know who decides what, who's influenced by whom, and how can we manage those relationships so that both the brand achieves the outcomes that we can deliver, and of course, from that comes the revenue that we want to generate or retain. And most importantly, do we have those relationships with all of them that we need to? If not, well, then there's your action item. I think it's incumbent on any vendor to build relationships as deep in the account as they possibly can. I think we're like a riff for a little bit. I think that we're seeing in today's economy that vendor and software spend and sprawl is scrutinized much more.
Yeah.
I also think that given the pace of technological advances, especially with all things AI, that the retention game is harder. So companies are more apt to, maybe they should evaluate the market every renewal cycle to weigh what they have, what the vendor can offer, and what the capabilities, gains, whatever, that they can get elsewhere. And that's why relationship management and depth is key. And having those deep, sprawling, strong relationships throughout a brand is crucial to retain and grow. I've seen too many times where we aren't deep enough or wide enough that, yeah, we're super tight with, quote, head of exec of something. They leave or get moved around and we're scrambling.
Yeah. How are you measuring that engagement today? So, because there's, if I think about it, there's building relationships and having relationship depth. That's a people thing, right? We have to execute in terms of being able to do that from a human standpoint. But then there's the, how do we know where to go? And how do we know where we lack that engagement so that we can go execute? And that's where the AI comes in. And you had an interesting post not too long ago where you talked about like the use cases for AI, the technology and the human side of things and how they play together. We'd love to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, for sure. To your first point, I think human account teams, as great as they are, it is quite enlightening when you do leverage the power of AI to help build what we need is, what is the white space? What's the stakeholder map, relationship map, whatever you want to call it?
Yeah.
And understand who's engaging, who's not, capture that data. And of course, Gen AI can also help produce a beautiful artsy relationship map for you as well. But no matter what solution you use, it's definitely worthwhile. I highly recommend anyone out there to leverage AI to help ensure a thorough map to help get to that ideal relationship depth. We think we know the people. We think we've talked to this person and talked to this person, and this is who's in what position. And maybe we bought, I won't say names of software companies, but maybe we bought this solution or that solution to help us map the white space. When you leverage AI, you get a much more thorough map on that.
Yeah. There's a really interesting dynamic that's going on right now, which is everybody's offering AI features to help. But a lot of companies are building, they want to build their own proprietary AI applications. And so it's like, we're kind of back to this buy versus build decision. What's core is we have to have good data as the foundation. That's a table stakes, right? But companies are wanting to build their own proprietary AI apps versus kind of what's coming out of the vendors. What's your perspective in terms of, are you guys building your own proprietary? You're trying to leverage more of the solutions, or is it a mixture of both?
So both, actually. Yeah, I mean, we see with a lot of our brands that are going down the AI and especially Gen AI in our world path, is that some of the more, I guess, advanced ones or the kind of the more forward leaning ones are, they want to build their own LLMs. They want to bring their own LLMs. In some cases, they'll bring their LLM and a AI agent provider. And that's, we're totally fine with that, because it's, I think that's where we will find ourselves in maybe the near future, the distant future, who knows, but we'll find ourselves where if you can't accommodate all of that and integrate with all of that, then you're kind of siloing yourself and you might be walling off some good revenue there.
Yeah. So are you finding that, is it a 50-50 mix? Is it 70% proprietary and 30% what we're getting from our providers? Like in your world, in order to get that depth and the signals of the of that engagement, what are you finding? Is it mostly you have to build it on your own, or is it something that you can buy sort of out of the box?
In the enterprise segment, we see a lot more willingness or desire and maybe human power to build your own, bring your own. But as you get more into the mid-market, especially down market, out of the box, for us, it's definitely somewhere in between there, where we are an AI company, so we have our own. And when we eat our own dog food, we eat some of that, and we bring some from elsewhere as well to help assist.
So, okay, let's break down what an AI-assisted relationship map looks like in your world. You're looking for engagement. You're looking for buying committee members that maybe you haven't spoken to before, not engaged, or people maybe who are engaged and dropping off. Like, how do you put that all together for that early warning system? And what are the different specific signals you look for on engagement?
Once you have your stakeholder map and your more holistic who's who in the zoo relationship map, then you're able to identify who's engaging, who's not, from a human qualified, and you got to capture that data in a systemic fashion, right? Yep. And then by leveraging the human qualified plus what we're getting from, we'll call it the systems, because whether it's AI or not, the system's telling you, here's all these other folks that you don't have engagement with, and here's the character traits about them and what you should go do. From there, at least for us, it's more human qualify at first.
Yeah.
Then use the system to match that up against what is the data telling us. And then obviously, and this is probably my most emerging new greatest use case, we're starting to leverage the Google suite with Gemini Enterprise to more seamlessly surface that customer data and insights and inform the early warning system. Being able to leverage that, and you're searching across the entire workspace for the entire company, right? So you can brand X, Y, or Z. What is the engagement like? I've got Gemini meeting notes from every single meeting that, or Gong or whatever, meeting notes from every single meeting that's happened with these folks. Who's there? Match that up against the relationship map or the stakeholder map, and who's not, who was there, who used to show up, and who's no longer. You just ask Gemini. It's quite lovely.
Yeah. Have you ran into any challenges from the embedding these into the CSM's workflows in terms of using the tools now and changing the behavior? And if you have, what recommendations do you give to overcome some of those?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think most tenured folks will always rely in part on their gut feelings, right? But if you have the data consistency and the system set up, when you're surfacing these kind of proactive notifications, hey, here's something interesting about your customer, or it's time for this, or whatever that call to action is, providing the links to the data sources in those notifications so the CSMs can cross, you got to get them confident in the data that's being served, the insights being serviced to them. So give them the links to the data sources so that they can cross-reference against their typical known good resources to help gain confidence. Also, providing the runbooks, plays, and prescriptive next steps is useful as well. It helps the less tenured CSMs to be guided for what to do next. More senior resources can sanity check with their champions at their brands and their guts. And when you have AI in the mix, you can leverage that as a co-pilot for the CSMs. Save time combing the data and strategizing what's next, and have the AI co-pilot recommend those next steps based on that contextual data. It's a huge time saver as well, because I think a lot of folks out there will definitely recognize the pain of the administrative part of any sort of customer success job.
Yeah. So how are you guys measuring the success of these different AI apps that you're putting together?
Adoption thereof is definitely very important. People still have to learn how to introduce these tools in their day-to-day. Like I said, with my Gemini use case, it's getting that mindset in the rhythm of doing so. But measuring the adoption of the tools, obviously at a business level, you measure the progress or improvement against NRR or GRR.
Yeah.
Those accounts with CS adopted AI versus those not. And progress against the risk profile in your business. Are you seeing a material decrease in at-risk ARR pre and post deployment of AI? And even depending on your CS and PS motions, cost to serve and productivity gains is, measured by time to value, progression on project, task, time saved, like especially on the delivery side.
What do you think's next? If you were to look at the next wave, not necessarily what you're looking to develop, but what you think the opportunities are for to leverage AI that you're not using today, what gets you excited?
I think the most, again, back to the administrative part of this job or any job, but when I think especially for CSMs, a lot of time saved, I should say, valuable time gained back to do more strategic things with your customers is the most exciting thing. Because harking back to when I was a CSM, this is the thing I hated the most. I think it's the thing that everybody hates most, is all that time spent. So when you talk about agentic AI or AI agents actually doing tasks, doing things for you, it's one thing to say, you already, dear AI, you already know everything about my customer, help me create a QBR deck that I will then still have to go in and curate, to being more of, I got reports that I got to do, insights to gather, I got to go into the product and do some things, and just leverage those AI agents, schedule them, and boom, it's right there for you. So you can just get that and go. That's what's most exciting.
What haven't I asked you yet about your either use of AI within your team or risks that we haven't discussed yet that you think people should be aware of and get ahead of as they're thinking about deploying AI solutions across their customer success team?
I think one of the things that often goes undiscussed would be the cross-functional adoption of these sorts of tooling. Being able to articulate the what's in it for me, for say a CSM to be able to be more efficient, effective, and strategic in their role is super important. But getting account teams, depending on the motion and depending on the products that are in play, account teams could be very large, much larger than an AE, a CSM, and maybe a pre-sales engineer. Yep. They could be very large. So getting that cross-functional team bought in on what's in it for them, be it faster quota retirement or KPI attainment or MBO attainment, that is probably the most important thing from an adoption perspective to make sure everybody is in the boat and on it.
So let's move into more of the lightning round, if you will, and a little more fun, a little more lighthearted, a little more personal. You've been, as you mentioned earlier, you started in the call center, you got into customer success, now you're leading a large team. What advice would you give to your younger self, knowing what you know now?
I would say probably when I stepped into being a CSM and learning what CSM is, the advice I would give that person, because this applies to anybody in customer success, whether you're a CSM itself or a CS leader, is know your book. Just you have a book, whether it's you've got these few accounts or you have an entire larger book of business, know it, know everything about it, be curious and believe that you don't know all, you don't know what you don't know, and don't be afraid to leverage resources, be it human or artificial, to help think bigger about what you can do with your book.
What makes you're starting to get into this a little bit, I think probably when you're giving your younger self advice, but what do you look for when you hire a CSM?
Absolutely. Growth mindset is definitely number one. I don't think we've reached passé with that term just yet. It is extremely critical. The best CSMs have to learn what the box is, and I have to be able to trust that they will learn the box and figure out, have a wherewithal to be curious to figure out how to break outside that box. I'm not saying go play outside the rules all day long, but if you're not able to understand not just what needs to be done and what the confines of that means, but how to go outside of that to make bigger, better things happen, looking for that curiosity is very important.
What about if you think about the CSMs that elevate the fastest, did they demonstrate those traits that you just spoke about? And what makes an exceptional CSM versus one in the middle?
Yeah, no, definitely. Of course, being curious, figuring out how to play in and outside the box. The best CSMs, we are a meticulous bunch. We are very organized. There's a lot of stuff going on. And so being able to keep organized, deliver on what needs to be delivered, understand that you are the voice of the company in a lot of scenarios, and being able to have the meticulousness, the curiosity, and an exec presence of sorts to be able to speak, because again, you're going to talk to the admins or the worker teams all the way up to C-level folks. The adaptable communication style is also very important.
What about building relationships cross-functionally with their AE partner? Different
modes.
Yeah.
I can't believe I didn't mention that part. That is ultra crucial. It's got to be the ultimate buddy system, whatever that account team looks like, but especially being completely interlocked with the account executive, and if there's a pre-sales engineer in there as well, being interlocked on the entire account strategy is number one importance, because there is who's on first, what's on second, and everybody has to be playing their different roles, but rowing towards one common goal that everybody agrees is the common goal.
Yeah, 100%. And is that led by the AE? Is that led by the CSM? Is it joint partners, like joint owners? What have you seen the best models that lead to the best outcomes?
The answer is it depends. And what it depends on is where the customer is at in their, not just their journey with your product set, but also where they're at from all of the things relationship-wise and all the other different kind of metadata markers, if you will, out there. But depending on where they're at, in a normal, in a perfect world, or a typical customer, I should say, the account executive will own the account strategy and the customer success manager will own the customer's strategy. How are we guiding the customer to achieve their outcomes so that the AE can capitalize and achieve our outcomes?
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. So we didn't talk about this earlier. How large is your team? When you look across, not just CSMs, but CSMs and solutions engineers and architects, how many people are underneath you?
I'm not an empire builder, so I don't go, look, how many do I got this time? I think the largest I had was 118, but that was VMware. Here, just with a mayor, in the neighborhood between 40 and 50.
Yeah. So leading a team of about 40 or 50 people, what's the favorite part of your job?
My favorite part of my job. This is probably going to be passe to say, but it is the people, period, full stop. Like, ironically, because we're on here talking about AI, but it is 100% about who you work with. That dictates satisfaction.
Now, there's always going to be a flip side to that question, Chad, but what's the least favorite part of your job?
Bad news. Churn. Especially nonsensical churn. The worst example I could give is a smaller automaker leaving us, not to a competitor, but they're killing digital customer engagement completely. And this isn't 1987.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. You obviously know quite a bit about customer success. You've been doing it for a long time. Where do you turn to for inspiration and new ideas?
Inspiration and call it creative thinking for new ideas, things that, you know, again, even I don't know what I don't know. So leveraging those colleagues that you've worked with in the past is, I think, one of the greatest places to go, because back to my experience at Splunk, where we were Rule of 40 hyper growth company, went from, when I was there, 2,000 person organization to an 8,000 person organization in less than 5 years. And so we've seen a lot of things, but since then the world has changed completely. That ended right around, my stint at Splunk ended right around when we came out of lockdown at COVID. And so a lot of folks that you've worked with typically go live and get experience elsewhere, typically in the same CS game. And so leveraging resources that you and call past colleagues to get fresh new ideas on what hasn't been tried. And then, of course, and if you can play this and rewind and put this next piece before that last piece, the most important thing is that you're talking to your people. Like, groupthink within your organization is so incredibly important, because we've got people from all different walks of life, all different backgrounds before they got to where they're at now. And so understanding where their head's at helps inform where the group can row together accordingly. And then, of course, your colleagues that you've worked with in the past that have gone elsewhere and learned plenty of other things.
Yeah, I 100% agree that the network, the people that you used to work with and how they've gone on and grown, and just sharing, just keeping that network fresh, and how are you approaching this, and super important. So when you're not focused on work and you're decompressing, what do you like to do to have fun and decompress?
Well, of course, my family. I've got a wife and 3 children, and they keep me plenty busy, but also golf, lots and lots of golf.
We got to play, Chad. I'm a big golfer as well. But I've got two young children myself, 7 and 4. So they're not quite self-sufficient. So my golf is I played about 15 rounds last year, but I love to get out when I can, for sure. And then now that with my daughter's 7, she's getting into sports, that eats into your Saturdays. So it's like that negotiation between, all right, I'll do this on Saturday morning and then I'll be back for the game and all that type of stuff. Yeah. What's your favorite course that you've played?
Favorite course that I've played. This is going to be embarrassing because I have not played that many courses, especially outside of Colorado. But the favorite, most beautiful one, I would say, is Arrowhead down in South Denver. Beautiful, kind of red rocks poking through. Sometimes you got to hit over them, especially if you got a slice like me.
How often do you get out?
But here's the best thing. My middle child, he is now 11. We live very close to a local golf course here. And whenever I come out of my home office, he's usually, especially obviously in the warm months in Colorado, "What's up, Dad? You want to go hit some holes?" "Oh, sorry, babe. I got to take care of the kid." And so it's after work, especially when the sun's up, obviously later.
Yeah.
I'll just say a lot.
Yeah.
It's fatherly duties.
I grew up on a golf course growing up, just our backyard. And back then, we used to have a junior pass. And the junior pass would be, as long as the first tee was clear, you can go out and play. And I've been playing since I was about 12 years old. And it's sad because when I was 18, I was probably a much better golfer than I am right now, because I used to play nearly every day. But yeah, no, that's one of my passions as well. Last question. If folks want to reach out to you, learn something today, and would like to talk with you, what's the best way to get in contact with you?
Definitely. Hit me up on LinkedIn. Very present there. May not post a bunch, but I'm definitely on LinkedIn is a great way to reach me.
Fantastic. Chad, I just want to thank you very much for taking the time out, sharing your expertise. I really appreciate it. And I'll wrap it up with just saying, I hope you have a great, great holiday. And we'll talk with you soon. I'll try to get up maybe next summer when I get out in Colorado.
Let's do it. Thank you, Randy.